This is program number 12 of the Does God Exist audio series. John Clayton is your speaker. In programs numbers 10 and 11, we have tried to talk about which God. Why the Bible? Why not the Quran? Why not the Vedas? Why not the writings of Baha'u'llah? One of the questions that inevitably comes up in a discussion like this is, well, if you're going to claim that the Bible is accurate, if you're going to claim that the Christian system is the way we should live, if you're going to maintain that the Bible is God-breathed, that it is accurate in its original writings, then how do you deal with evolution? Our very first comment, our very first major point in this series, has been to say that science and the Bible, science and faith, are friends, not enemies. They support each other. They reinforce each other. They exist in a symbiotic relationship, each mutually beneficial to the other. And I told you about the student I had who was a brilliant, highly gifted science student, but who felt that if he went into science, he had to give up his faith. And I've tried to say to you that that's a destructive attitude. It's destructive to science. It's destructive to faith. And so we immediately run into this question, not only about the credibility of the Bible, but are science and faith compatible in the subject of evolution? And I'm going to beg you in this discussion to leave your preconceived notions at home. I think one of the problems here has been that people have not approached the subject of evolution in an equitable, open-minded, fair way. I've been in churches where if I said I believe in evolution, the reaction was, oh, you can't believe in evolution and believe in God. And that's a horrible attitude. That's a mistaken concept. You have to define your words. You have to indicate what you mean. And I maintain that science and faith are compatible disciplines. They reinforce each other. And I would suggest to you that the best minds in science have recognized this. One of my favorite quotes was from Dr. Henry Schaefer, who's one of the most brilliant scientists in the United States for many, many years, highly acclaimed and recognized, but also a believer. Dr. Schaefer said, "The significance and joy of my science comes on those occasional moments of discovering something new and saying to myself, so that's how God did it. My goal is to understand a little corner of God's plan." End of quote. Francis Collins, the director of the Human Genome Project, has written a book called The Language of God. And again, his basic thesis is to better understand the concept of how God has done what he has done. And we might disagree with some of his understandings. One of the dangers in coming out and saying science and faith are compatible is that science changes. Understandings change. And so almost anything you write becomes out of date almost immediately. But I think there's such a wealth of information that shows the compatibility of science and faith. And in the next several presentations on this series, I hope I can share with you some things that will help you in understanding. Darwin said one time, "I looked at everything as resulting from design laws, with the details left to the working out of what we may call chance. Not that this notion at all satisfies me. I feel most deeply that the whole subject is too profound for the human intellect." End of quote. Well, if there's design laws, there has to be a designer. And one of the things that immediately comes up is that people say, "Well, what do you think about the evolution creation controversy?" And ladies and gentlemen, there never has been, never will be, never could be an evolution creation controversy, because evolution doesn't deal with creation. It's important to understand that the word creation, the way we started program number 1 and 2, is the concept of creating time, space, matter, energy, life, the human soul. It doesn't have anything to do with what evolution talks about. Evolution assumes all those things. Evolution assumes that time has been created. Evolution assumes that space has been created. Evolution assumes that matter energy has been created. Evolution assumes that matter energy became organized in a way that could produce stable matter. Evolution assumes that that matter developed in such a way that it was able to support a solar system that could support carbon-based, water-based life, and that at least in one place throughout the cosmos that actually happened. Once all those assumptions had been made, then evolution tries to explain how things changed from that to what we see today. But that's not creation. That's changes in things already created. I always cringe when somebody says something like, well, I don't believe in God because of evolution. That's a pretty ignorant statement. Evolution has nothing to do with the existence of God. Francis Collins and many other scientists who are also believers are convinced that evolution is simply a tool of God. And one of the problems here that immediately comes up is the question of what do we mean by evolution? The word evolution means an unfolding type of change, literally. An unfolding type of change. And everything is evolving. Everything is changing. You're evolving from a baby to an old man or old woman. The United States is evolving. You may think it's devolving, but that's a political perspective. We use the word evolution to talk about all kinds of inanimate objects. The evolution of modern music, the evolution of modern art. But it's also true biologically. I can show you a picture of a 40-pound radish. And incidentally, this 40-pound radish is a new species of radish. The biology book defines the word species as a group of plants or animals that can interbreed and produce fertile offspring. These radishes cannot interbreed with their great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grand radish and produce fertile offspring. They are sterile in terms of being able to produce fertile offspring. And there are many examples like that. What you need to understand is that the word species is not the same as the word kind. The biblical word kind is a Hebrew word min, M-I-N. Let me quote 1 Corinthians 15:39. The Apostle Paul says, all flesh is not the same flesh. But there is one kind of flesh of man, and another kind of flesh of beast, and another kind of flesh of fishes, and another kind of flesh of birds. Now, may I point out to you, he didn't say the flesh of blue jay, the flesh of Canadian jay, the flesh of stellar jay. He said the flesh of birds. He didn't say the flesh of carp, the flesh of goldfish, the flesh of buffalo fish, the flesh of black bass. He said the flesh of fish. The word species and the word kind do not mean the same thing. New species do come into existence. New kinds don't. And it's important to understand that when you say, I believe in evolution, a lot of people have a very different concept than what I have when I make that statement. There were no peekaboos on Noah's Ark. Now, whether you talk about the peekaboo or the cockapoo or the miniature St. Bernard, all of these dogs evolved from some ancient dog-like ancestor. And you say, well, that's not evolution, that's variation. The biology book calls it evolution. The BSCS Blue Version Biology book, Molecules to Man, perhaps the most evolutionarily oriented textbook ever written for high school students, the version that I have in front of me has 28 chapters. 24 of those 28 chapters deal with this kind of change. We all know about the Charlet. You may be familiar with the Beefalo. If you've traveled to Scotland or Ireland, you have seen the Highland Cues. Evolution. I have a picture I can show you of a cross between a goat and a sheep. It's called a jeep. And I'm not being funny here. I'm talking about a real animal that is fertile. We take people on trips down the Grand Canyon, and one of my favorite activities is that if we have animals running along beside the rafts, and if they are not made up of males, I will ask people on boat, is that a sheep or a goat? And unless you're pretty highly trained, you can't tell, because they are so similar in many, many ways. And the Bible talks about this kind of evolution. Do you remember what Jacob did with Laban's flocks? Evolution. It's important to understand that the word evolution is not a dirty word. When you hear somebody say evolution is a fact, they're talking about the kinds of change that I have been describing. And somebody says, well, that's microevolution. And if microevolution happens, but not macroevolution. Well, the problem with that discussion is, where does micro end and macro begin? How about the Jeep? I mentioned a few minutes ago. It's kind of important to understand that when people talk about evolution, there's a difference between the fact of evolution and all of the theories of evolution. The fact of evolution is that living things change. It is the basis of modern agriculture, modern horticulture, and it is very factual. When you talk about the various theories of evolution, you're dealing with a whole different situation. Most of us are familiar with Neo-Darwinism, built along some very easy-to-understand principles. But Niles Eldridge and some of the people that worked with him back in the 80s and 90s, Stephen Jay Gould in particular, came up with a concept called punctuated equilibrium. That's a variant of Neo-Darwinism. Today, there's a theory known as cladistic taxonomic drift. These are theories of evolution. People struggling to understand how evolutionary principles work. In February of 2013, I had the privilege to travel to the Galapagos Islands. I had the opportunity to visit the Charles Darwin Research Station in the Galapagos Islands. And everything I saw there was a discussion of the kind of evolutionary change about which I've been talking. Studies done on the tortoises and how they are genetically different from island to island. Studies done on the iguanas. Animals that have connections to the mainland, but in some cases have become radically different. The marine iguanas have learned or have adapted to being able to feed on the floor of the ocean. Very different than the land iguanas. One of the problems here is that there is confusion between the word evolution and the word naturalism. Evolution is an unfolding type of change. The Bible talks about evolution. You remember what the serpent had happened to him? There was a curse given to the serpent. From now on you will crawl upon thy belly in the dust of the earth, and of the dust of the earth shalt thou eat all the days of thy life. How did the serpent get around before that? I suggest to you he had legs. And however you interpret that particular story, the important thing to understand is that there was change. Change is the operating force throughout the creation, not to be confused with naturalism. Naturalism is a philosophy. Naturalism is a belief that everything can be explained by science, that there is a natural explanation for everything that we can possibly dream of or conceive of. And somebody who believes in naturalism would reject the concept of God having a role in the creation because everything can be explained in terms of natural process. So we're talking about evolution. We're talking about how evolution matches the Bible. I also want to make sure that you understand here that we're not going to deal in great depth with the biological processes of evolution. If you take a course in evolution at the high school or college level, there will be evidences provided for evolution, evidences that there is change. Comparative morphology, for example, the comparison of body parts. Comparative embryology, the way embryos develop inside their mothers or inside an egg. Comparative physiology, the chemistry of the organisms that make up the earth. Vestigial organs, organs that at one time were functional and because of disuse are no longer functional. Classic example might be earlobes or wisdom teeth. The presence of cavemen, the genetic evidence. All of these are biological arguments. They're all good arguments. They all need to be understood. They are helpful in determining the future of how we're going to operate in medicine, how we're going to operate in agriculture, in horticulture, in the world in which we live, how we're going to feed the growing population, how we're going to combat disease, how we're going to oppose the ravages of pollution and the abuse that man has put upon the earth system. But as far as the question of what has happened in the past, the evidence for evolution has to hang on the fossil record. The reason for that is that the fossil record is the record that gives the history of what has taken place. Grassi, in his famous textbook on evolution, page 4, makes this statement. The process of evolution is revealed only through fossil forms. A knowledge of paleontology is therefore a prerequisite. Only paleontology can provide the evidence of evolution and reveal its course or mechanisms. I realize that geneticists would probably argue that in terms of modern discoveries, but the fact is that the fossil record holds the history of what actually took place. You can have the most wonderful biological model. You can offer all kinds of support for what genetically might have been possible, but what actually took place will be revealed in the fossils. And so we're going to confine our discussion here to what the fossil record has to say. And as a high school earth science teacher, that's the area I'm most familiar with anyway. I'm not a biologist. There have been tons of books written about the biological processes involved in evolution. There are people who are trained in genetics who have written wonderful manuscripts and wonderful understandings. I enjoy reading what they have said in their disciplines, but I'm certainly not qualified to comment in those areas. What I'm interested in is, how does the fossil record support the biblical record? Are science and faith, science and the Bible, at odds about the history of the earth and how life has changed on the earth? Now, the first thing I want to say to you about fossils is they're real. Fossils are found everywhere. If you were to come where I live in the area of southern Michigan, southwestern Michigan, and we were to go out and go into our local gravel pit, we would find all kinds of interesting fossils. The fossils that we find in the rocks around here are made up of clam shells. They're made up of what's called the devil's toenail, which is a kind of scallop. We find the Petoskey stone. That's Michigan State rock. And it's a coral. Interestingly enough, it's a coral that can only grow in water that is warmer than 68 degrees. Do I have to tell you that Michigan is not a tropical paradise? There have been changes. And the conditions here have not always been as they are now. It's also interesting to realize that as you travel around and look at fossils, you see animals that are different than animals living today. Years ago in Cairo, Illinois, a friend of mine found a good part of some shark jaws. Now, this is at the intersection of the Ohio and the Mississippi River, a long, long way from the nearest ocean. And this shark is incredibly large. It's called a carcadon. It'd make a gray white look like a minnow. There have been enormous changes. I have a picture of a carcadon tooth that must be probably 50 times as big as a large gray white tooth. So animals have lived in the past that are very different than animals living today. And animals have lived in the past that are so radically different today that they have a whole different message to tell. Animals we call dinosaurs. When I was a kid, I was driving a guy out west, and we were going to the west coast from Bloomington, Indiana. We went through Vernal, Utah, went by Dinosaur National Park. And this guy's in the back seat, and we went by the park, and I said to him, "Hey, let's go in and see the dinosaurs." And his response was, "I don't believe in dinosaurs, and I don't want to see any either." You can take that kind of position, but these animals lived. And they indicate a very different type of lifestyle and a very different type of environmental condition than what we see today. You say, "Well, how do you know that?" Well, let me tell you a personal story. I had two little girls that grew up in my house, two daughters, and I was the kind of father who loved to play jokes on my kids. And one July morning, I went out on our patio, and there was this toad that had crawled up on the patio, and the sun had baked him out. So here's this dried up, shriveled up toad stuck on the patio behind the house. So I thought this would be a wonderful opportunity to play a joke on my daughter. So I peeled him off the patio and put him under the bacon on the breakfast table. And now, wait a minute, don't get ahead of me here. I had him covered with saran wrap, so there's no big biological hazard. Well, my older daughter came down, the one who is a landscape architect and owns a company that puts in wonderful gardens and does wonderful things with improving the looks of houses. And she always used to brag at the fact that she didn't know where the science building was on campus. But anyway, she picked up the piece of bacon and saw the toad and made the intended and desired response. "Yuck! Daddy!" And that sends her sailing out of the living room. Well, that brings her sister down. Her sister is now a biology teacher. And she looks at her sister, who is refusing to re-enter the kitchen. She looks at the toad under the bacon. She looks at me, she rolled her eyes, she picked up the toad, took him out of my office, and stapled him to my bulletin board. Do you know that toad is still stuck to that bulletin board? And it's been over 30 years since that incident happened. And my point in telling you that story is that sometimes animals can be preserved in remarkable ways that leave no doubt about what they look like or about what was a part of them. The process, in this case, is called dehydration. And we have dinosaurs who have been dehydrated. I can show you skin sections of dinosaurs so that you can see the cell structure. You can't always tell what the color is, although in some cases you can even do that, but colors do get modified. I can show you all kinds of the remains of skin and all kinds of other materials that were a part of the dinosaurs. And by the way, a lot of people don't seem to understand that most of the dinosaurs were not the great big guys. A vast percentage of dinosaurs were perhaps the size of a cocker spaniel. And the largest animal that has ever lived on the earth today is the blue whale. A blue whale's aorta is so large that I could swim through it. And I'm a pretty big man. So many of the animals that have lived in the past were not that big. And we have wonderful preserved specimens. We also have coprolite. I don't know any polite way of saying this, but coprolite is dinosaur poop. That has been preserved, dried out, and is basically a rock. I have a piece that I show in my lectures. It's a piece that I have taken a slice out of. And if you look at that slice under the microscope, you will see that the coprolite, the dinosaur poop, is made up of almost entirely plant material. There are seeds, there are leaves, there are stalks. Pretty obviously, the animal was a vegetarian. I can show you another piece of dinosaur poop, which is almost entirely made out of animal remains. One pile of dinosaur poop has, I think, we counted 100 and some odd different teeth in the dinosaur poop. Pieces of skin, pieces of bone. Well, pretty obviously, those remains indicate this was a carnivorous dinosaur. There's no plant material in it at all. That kind of thing tells us a lot about the dinosaurs. Tells us a lot about the conditions under which they lived. It's also interesting to realize that sometimes there are misrepresentations. For many years, there were pictures of Tyrannosaurus rex, which showed little tiny front legs on the animal. The reason was that they had not found a complete specimen, and they assumed that he didn't need big front legs for anything, but recently we have found a complete skeleton, and the front legs are very, very large, and they have a claw on them that could have been very useful as a defense mechanism. As a matter of fact, in Chicago, there is a complete reconstruction of the best found intact Tyrannosaurus rex. It's called Sue, in honor of the person that found it. And what's interesting about Sue is that the head of that animal could not be mounted on the body because the head was so massive that they had to make a plastic head because they didn't have strong enough metal to hold the skull in place. So you'll find the head in a separate case away from the main body of the specimen. Most of the Tyrannosaurus rexes probably were not big animals that ran around at high speeds eating cars or whatever you might have seen in Jurassic Park. Most of them were probably scavengers. As a matter of fact, they were probably the vultures of the time. So these animals lived. I can show you pictures of dinosaur eggs, in some cases with the baby still inside. Very complete. As a matter of fact, in China, there have recently been found large numbers of dinosaur eggs. And the developmental process that went on in the dinosaur eggs is very easy to find. They have even found one dinosaur nest with the mother still sitting on the eggs because she was smothered by a sandstorm. And the result is that we have a complete record of what took place. Many of the dinosaurs look like birds in many ways, and there have even been feathers found on many of them. Well, I've tried to give you just a general idea of the way in which these specimens have been found. In our next presentation, we want to talk a little bit more about some of the other information about these animals, how they lived, how long ago they lived, and how that might connect with what the Bible has to say.